Turn that guitar up.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century look at history's greatest rock bands. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, Def Leppard's Joe Elliott premieres a scorching hot concert film live from Detroit.
Guys, I said, I think we really owe it to ourselves to kind of document ourselves the way we are now. You know, Vivian's been in the band nearly a quarter of a century, and it's kind of mad that the last thing that we put out was on VHS tape. The radio taught us 3-minute rock and roll. You know, I mean, there were big guitars on Rebel Rebel and Gene Genie and Metal Guru and Get It On. And there was big guitars on Come and Feel the Noise and Mama We're All Crazy Now. Two songs ironically covered by an American band called Quiet Riot in the 80s and were bigger hits for them than they ever were for Slade in America. Hey, this is Joe Elliott of Def Leppard in the studio with Redbeard, and there will be a next time.
Hey, I was stunned by a quote in your press release that's attributed to you, and here's the quote. It said, "We hadn't actually had a live performance filmed since 1988. Joe, is that possible?
Yes and no. Yeah, we've been filmed many times, but not commercially, if you like. You know, there's been... Obviously, there's guest appearances on TV. There was things like the Freddie Mercury tribute show that we were part of. We've had some broadcasts on TV, like there was an Italian one in 93 and there was a Japanese one in 99. And we did, of course, record and, you know, release the Viva Hysteria Blu-ray DVD back in 2013. But that was essentially like a special recording of a start to finish live version of Hysteria. It wasn't wasn't just like a live performance of the band, like you'd say, go and see McCartney or the Stones or Springsteen, where you're kind of getting a mixture of new material and a greatest hit show or whatever. It was specifically Hysteria. But this is the first time that we've actually filmed and released a performance of us on tour, as it were, since 88, yeah. Guys, I said, I think we really owe it to ourselves to kind of document ourselves the way we are now. Vivian's been in the band nearly a quarter of a century, and it's kind of mad that the last thing that we put out was on VHS tape.
Let's Go originally appeared on Def Leppard's strong 2015 studio album, and lead singer Joe Elliott confirms that was purposely conceived.
Sav wrote that song mostly. You know, as I said when we did the press release for the album, yeah, it's credited to Savage Elliott, but the truth is it should be in capital letters for him and small print for mine. It was written as an opener. It was written as a classic Def Leppard song. We weren't trying to do a pastiche. We just wanted to carry on where we've left off in the past, if you like. You know, you look at a band like Aerosmith or AC/DC, you can kind of guess where they're going to come from, because they're not going to throw 360s at you the way, say, David Bowie might have done, or other artists that are mostly solo artists could do that. But bands have a different headspace and a different method of working. Yeah, we all come to the table with different ideas, and those different ideas are like four solo albums that all end up on one record, you know. But if you look at what I contributed to this record, it's like maybe three full songs and bits to other people, and Phil came in with three full songs and bits to other people's, and it all balances out at the end of the day. But you know, it was written with it was written to be sang on stage. It wasn't written to be heard purely as a piece of art, the way, say, a song like We Belong or Blind Faith is. It was written to be performed on stage, because it's questioning the crack. Do you really want to do this now? It's like fooling. Had, you know, is anybody out there? You can point at the people and get a response. It's a call to arms. It's, you know, it's that kind of a song. So it was always, when he first played the demo, I remember it was all in the room, all looking at each other going, oh yeah, this is gonna work. I only wrote the verses for that. Sav wrote the melodies and the chorus and all that kind of stuff. And he really nailed it, you know. And he's really coming into his own as a songwriter. You listen to some of the stuff that he's written recently, things like Come On, Come On off the Sparkle Lounge album, Kings of the World, which was one of the new songs on the end of Mirrorball, the live album from like 5 years ago, whenever it was. He's always been a great contributor to songs, but now it's a case of he's delivering the finished thing with maybe just a few holes that need filling in. And he just said, look, you go write the verses, we'll get on with doing something else. And that's how we approached this whole project.
I reminded Joe Elliott about a debate in the music business about 15 years ago of the fear that making high-quality concert films for the growing home theater market would cannibalize actual concert ticket sales.
Maybe 15 years ago, for certain acts, it was deemed not a good idea. But I think everything seems to have settled down, and it doesn't seem to have done anybody any harm. I think I've always believed that people, no matter how much they lock themselves in their bedroom under headphones, as opposed to sharing the way that, say, we all did when MTV first kicked in around about 81, 82, you know, you'd sit down in your bedroom with your mates and watch the latest ZZ Top video for the cars, the girls, and the furry guitars sort of thing. Now everybody seems to be on their headphones. I think that somewhere in between there are enough people on the planet that actually want to rub shoulders with other human beings in a live environment. And I think that's why the live thing has got more popular, if not maintained its popularity. I think it maybe even got more popular. And that kind of makes that all null and void about, you know, DVDs and, you know, whatever format you want to talk about is going to kill music. It really isn't, I don't think. If anything, it may lead people to want to go and see them in actual live situations rather than just the 2D flat screen version. It's almost like become like a church. You know, it's a place where people get together Sunday mornings to worship whichever God they choose. And with rock music, it's where you go to celebrate the life's work of an artist, whether it be one album and that life's work is 6 or 7 months, or whether it be the Stones or, you know, McCartney, where you're looking at a 50-year career, or anywhere in between. I think that people just need contact, and sometimes that isolation just makes that more obvious.
You know, I was really impressed by how well the guys support you live with the call and response backing vocals. For instance, on Animal, who is that? It's really strong.
Well, the choruses on Animal, I sing the high harmony on the second half, but I let the crowd sing the first bit. You know, it's getting the crowd involved. We want them to be the sixth member of the band when we're playing live. We've always wanted them to do that. You know, I've done some shows outside of Leopard with people like, you know, Duff McKagan and Matt Sorum and Gilby Clark, who played with Guns N' Roses. And when we were in South America, we'd be doing some of our songs and some of their songs. And I remember Duff and Gilby coming up to me going, dude, people sing your stuff. They mosh 2 hours, but they sing your songs, you know, the whole crowd. And that's exactly how it is at a Leopard gig. And people sometimes don't even realize that, but the crowd is singing every word. So it's not just the choruses, they're singing the whole thing. But yeah, all three of the guys, the out front, you know, Rick doesn't sing. We took that responsibility off him because there's so much somebody to be doing with his, you know, with his kit, and specifically with him being, you know, one man down in the arm department, as it were. Yeah, we like to keep the whole anchors down, and we'll worry about the vocals. So the four of us, we split the things up, and people just take different parts, and I normally take the very high bits. So what we did on the record version of Animal, where there was, like, you know, all four of us and maybe Mutt around the mic singing the high harmony on Animal a dozen times and multi-tracking it up, I get to do that all on my own. But it somehow works because the crowd kind of, they become your double track, you know.
The definitive version of Let It Go, originally on Def Leppard's second album, High and Dry, now is found on the new DVD or Blu-ray with double CD called And There Will Be a Next Time, live from Detroit. The next best thing to being there, seeing and hearing Def Leppard today. When we come back, Joe Elliott explains how their current performance of that 35-year-old song can be better than ever. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Def Leppard lead singer Joe Elliott for And There Will Be a Next Time.
Hey, this is Joe Elliott of Def Leppard in the studio with Redbeard, and there will be a next time.
Thank you, Joe. When asked how Def Leppard can tear into material written in the early 80s with more fire and conviction than ever, Joe Elliott had a simple but revealing answer.
There's two ways of looking at that. When you record a song for the first time, or by the time you actually get it down on tape, you maybe played it a dozen times. You know, I mean, we've seen the Beatles anthology thing, and it'll say like take 29 or take 30. So maybe you do 30 takes, you know, but it's still fresh. It's new. You're learning it. When you come to playing a song 30 years, 35 years after it was released, it's now in your DNA. So for myself, Rick, and Rick Savage, it is totally inbuilt in the DNA. We were there from its conception, and we'll be there at its demise, no doubt, as well. But for the other part of that equation is that it's two different guitar players to what played on the record. So they're listening to it with different heads than say, the two Ricks and myself, you know. Phil's always the one that's wanting to play the stuff up high and dry because he's such a fan of the record that he appreciates what Steve and Pete Willis did on that album. And the same thing with Vivian, you know. So they bring a different flavor to it. Not any better, not any worse, just different, you know. But it does give it an edge, I suppose. And the fact that we can be playing that song 35 years after it was born with the same amount of enthusiasm as we did when we started out, if not more, I think it's a testament to the band that, you know, we're in it for the long haul, and that includes certain songs. Well, it's a band, you know. None of us think that we're the star, you know. As I've said before, when you've got five alpha males in a band, you have to realize who the boss is, and we quickly established that the boss is the song, you know, and we adapt ourselves to suit. So if you're approaching anything in life, sometimes you have to adapt on a minute by minute, an hour by hour, day by day basis to how you're going to approach whatever it is you're approaching, you know. And when it comes to doing certain songs, you know, there might not be many guitar parts in it, so the guys know they're going to be singing more than playing. And then there's other songs where they're playing more than singing, and it's not a case of there's anybody in this band says, I don't want to be in that kind of band. I just want to play guitar all night and I don't want to sing, or I want to sing and I don't want to play guitar. Everybody's got their role to play, and we approach each song with its own rules, if you like. And because of the ego-free situation that we've found ourselves in when it comes to this approach, it works terrifically for a band like us. It's been knocking around since Sparkle Lounge in 2008, as a lot of these songs were. That's why this album was such a breeze to do, because we'd let all these little ideas percolate. You know, it's nothing new for us. You know, Photograph on Pyromania was a half of that, at least, was a leftover from High and Dry that never got finished. And that goes on. You know, I mean, I've heard some great stories that Tattoo You by the Stones in 81. Most of those tracks were pulled out the archives by Chris Kimsey, going back to Black and Blue and It's Only Rock and Roll Even. You know, they just never got finished. And a great idea is a great idea. And just because you're aware that it's maybe 5 or 6 years old doesn't mean that you should abandon it if it comes back round into its place 5 or 6 years later, you know. We just weren't in a position to record these songs because we were out on the road. We weren't in the headspace to make a new record. But when we were, we had a bucket load of riffs and ideas to pick from. We weren't like starting from scratch, which was a great thing. So when we had this song that Phil had been messing with, and it was originally called Dangerous Drug, and we were trying to, you know, that was his whole prospect of it. He was just using that as a metaphor. And we were working on it. And I said, Phil, I can't get it to fit. You know, any kind of decent melody or rhythm, I want to drop the word drug and just call it Dangerous. And he's like, yeah, okay. There was no fight. You know, I mean, that was a great thing about it. It was like, look, if you've got a vision for this, go with it, you know. The riff was always there, and it's classic Leppard. You know, it's taken from that school of, you know, Photograph or Promises, where it's a kind of a jangly staccato intro, if you like, that breaks into just massive big chords. And that's what we love to do, you know. We unashamedly love the commerciality and rock mixed together, you know. So it, with it only having two or three chords in the verse, it just gives you so much scope for melody. When if you're stuck with a riff, sometimes you just can't move or veer away from it. So we all, you know, we're all, the lot of us are very aware of the scope that a Lennon and a McCartney or a Jagger and Richards have had over the years to be able to move great melodies around, because they keep their chord sequences pretty low key and simple. I think it was Bono that once said, you know, that you two are three chords and the truth. Well, you know, we're three chords and a little white lie, if you like, because we don't take the same like lyrical approach that Bono might on most of our stuff, but we like to portray a song and sow that seed into the listener's head that they can take this any which way they like, you know. And Dangerous is one of those songs.
I love that song, Def Leppard with Dangerous from 2015, and now a kickin' live version on the Next Time Live from Detroit DVD and CD. One of the real treats to a Def Leppard concert is their impeccable choices in rock chestnuts to cover. You know, the right surprise left turn at the right time in the set. Such is the case when Def Leppard covers the 1973 David Essex song Rock On. Joe Elliott remembers hearing it for the first time on the radio in Sheffield, England.
Well, it was mind-blowing because it was a pop song, but it was done with a rock format. And that's what a lot of music that we heard in the UK was. You have to remember that unlike America, where you've got, you know, maybe seven or eight stations in each state, maybe two or three stations in each city, which should be on maybe 24 hours a day in FM, playing nothing but album tracks. All we had was one top 40 station nationwide, and that was it. And after that, you're tuning into classical music, talk radio that covers politics, or easy listening music like Andy Williams and Perry Como. So we were force-fed a mixture of Tie a Yellow Ribbon by Tony Orlando and Come On Feel the Noise by Slade and anything in between, you know. So we were limited into what we heard, unless you had an older brother with a great record collection, and because he was a student, which I didn't have, you know, or a mate down the corner of the street, which I did have, who was introduced me to the likes of Jethro Tull and Rod Stewart and all this kind of stuff. But the radio taught us 3-minute rock and roll. You know, I mean, there were big guitars on Rebel Rebel and Gene Genie and Metal Guru and Get It On. And there was big guitars on Come On Feel the Noise and Mama We're All Crazy Now, two songs ironically covered by an American band called Quiet Riot in the 80s, and were bigger hits for them than they ever were for Slade in America. But those big drums, big choruses, big guitars is what taught us who we are, you know. But we also had I wouldn't say a softer side, but we had an open ear for other types of music other than like what you might call full-on hard rock, you know. And David Essex had a bunch of stuff that was truly groundbreaking from a pop point of view, because it was incredible arrangements by, I forget who it was. It may have been Jeff Wayne, actually, who did War of the Worlds. But he had Mike Garson on keyboards, who played with David Bowie. He had Herbie Flowers on bass, who played with T-Rex and David Bowie. He had a great array of musicians around him. And songs like America and songs like Stardust and specifically Rock On were songs that we all, over the years when we've been discussing pop music, would all look at each other and go, that's a great song. There was none of that like, oh, that's just, you know, poncy pop music. It was like really cleverly done. So when we were choosing the songs to put on the Air album, you know, 99% of the media that cover us all the time would be expecting us to be playing stuff like Sabbath and Zeppelin and stuff like that. And it was just never, ever going to be that, you know. We wanted to show the world where we truly came from. So that's why we had stuff like Blondie, Badfinger, ELO, and David Essex on that record, along with Bowie and T-Rex. And there's Kinks, yeah. You know, like I say, they were staple stuff on the radio. In even when we were kids, I'll be the first to admit that when I was 6 or 7, I didn't really know why I liked the Kinks, but I know now why I liked them then, because I just had a musical ear that hadn't quite developed, but that was obviously my thing. I was just honed in to certain stuff. And when I heard the Kinks or the Who or the Small Faces, it stuck out more than Jerry and the Pacemakers or the Tremolos. It just did, you know, with the greatest respect to those last two artists. The Kinks were a real band and Ray Davies and, to a lesser extent, Dave Davies were really good songwriters, and they had a garage band punk sensibility that we didn't realize that then until you can get to compare it to what happened in 76. But you listen back and you realize that they were probably a band that were really admired by the likes of Lydon and Summer and, you know, and Joe Strummer and all that kind of, you know, Sting and people like that. They were really awesome acts, you know. But at the same time, there was a great array of pop songs in the charts that really people, I know, I was one of them, would buy things like Crazy Horses by the Osmonds, but take it home in a brown paper bag so you didn't get beaten up at the bus stop, you know. But there's a great crowd, a couple of guys that were on KLOS in LA called Mark and Brian, never heard Crazy Horses by the Osmonds. So I got up to dig it up while we were live on the air, and they played it off YouTube. And they were both, you know, astonished at how heavy it was, you know. I mean, it's just a great song. The fact that it was the Osmonds put everybody off if you were a rocker, and nobody dare admit it. But we came from a different headspace where we didn't have to deny ourselves. You know, I mean, if you like the Bay City Rollers, you like the Bay City Rollers. You know, people in certain areas of the world cannot understand how somebody can say you really like David Essex and Led Zeppelin. And I'm like going, well, why not? You're just limiting yourself if you only like one type of thing. And that's why we've always had such a broad musical canvas to paint on, because we come from such different eclectic backgrounds within the realms of what pop and rock is.
Fabulous performance of David Essex, Rock On by Def Leppard on the And There Will Be a Next Time, where they rolled out another new song entitled Man Enough. Again, Def Leppard lead singer Joe Elliott.
Phil came in with a riff. He says, I've got this bass lick. And so we all went, yeah. I mean, it sounds a bit like Queen. So we all went, okay. You know, now 10 years ago, we might go, oh, well, we can't go there then. On this album, we actually said, let's wear our musical heroes and influencers like tattoos. Let's just keep them exposed on the outside. Instead of trying to bury them and hide them, let's just say, somebody says, oh, it sounds like Queen, we go, yeah, what's your point? You know, this song sounds like The Who. Yeah, what's your point? You know, of course it does. We grew up listening to him. You know, you listen to Jimmy Page and his stuff sounds like Leadbelly or John Lee Hooker. And he would say, yeah, what's your point?
What's your point?
You know, we have our influences. Of course we do. What you do with them is what makes you better than the other band that came up at the same time as you, or gives you that opportunity to outlast, because you have a natural born talent to take what were your influences and mix them in with your own, you know. So once he came up with this, you know, this basic, and he played it to Sav, and Sav went, give me the bass. And Sav starts playing it, and Rick starts playing the drums, and then Phil starts throwing in little chuggy guitar licks and stuff like that. We just put the basic track together, and I said, don't giggle, but I've got this idea that's kind of half comical for the lyric, you know, you man enough to be my woman. And we worked in it, and it's like, well, woman doesn't fit, so okay, change it to girl, you know, it's the same thing. Because we have to make sure that it's a phonetic fit as well as a lyrical fit, which is why I've always said, and you can quote me here 1,000 times, I'm all for, you know, the answer my friend is blowing in the wind, God bless you, but, you know, she had a hubcap diamond star halo, which is what Mark Boland sung on, I think it was Get It On. You know, it's just like, what's one of those? And the answer is, who cares? It sounds amazing. So that's a big part of our DNA as well, is just we want it to sound good. It's got to be phonetic. It's got to have a rappiness to it even, you know. So once we put that together and it's like, oh, this is just going in all the right directions for us, that song was born pretty quickly. We're not really gender bending on it. It's more a case of like, you know, are you man enough to stand up for it? Are you big enough is really what it's representing. It's like, are you brave enough, you know? And it's just, it's a play on words. That's all it is. It's not a sexist statement or anything like that. It's just us having fun with the English language, which is what we like to do, you know? The English language is so ripe for picking when you say something that you don't mean, or somebody else thinks that you mean something different to what you said. We try and incorporate that into our lyrics a lot. A lot of it comes from humor of, you know, John Cleese in Fawlty Towers, or the Three Stooges, or the Marx Brothers even. You know, we mix a lot of that in with all the sensible stuff. Keeps us sane, you know.
Joe Elliott of Def Leppard returns with a classic song vital to the band's early success in America. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at InTheStudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Def Leppard's lead singer Joe Elliott for And There Will Be a Next Time.
Hey, this is Joe Elliott of Def Leppard in the studio with Redbeard, and there will be a next time.
Thanks, mate. I asked Def Leppard lead singer, songwriter Joe Elliott a penny for his thoughts when he sees the song Bringin' On the Heartbreak pop up on the concert performance set list.
There are certain songs that they just mean so much, you know, not necessarily to us, but to the audience. And when we play that song, and we've done it a bunch of different ways, sometimes we do it acoustically, we're back to doing it electric, but when we start that song off with that kind of twin guitar lead intro and you hear the crowd go bonkers the same way that when you listen to a Zeppelin live record, the beginning of Stairway to Heaven kicks in and the crowd go bonkers. It's one of those songs. It was the first song to really be taken notice of back in 1982, a good year after we released it, because of the MTV video. The song started getting played on MTV, then he started getting requested on radio, and all of a sudden the song became like a minor hit, if you like, a year after it came out, and it's just grown and grown and grown ever since. It's a very important song in the Leppard catalogue, for sure.
Joe, at the very end of your live performance of the song Hysteria, you did a touching musical nod to David Bowie. Tell me what David Bowie means and meant to you, first as a fan, and later as a professional, you know, musician and performer.
But Top of the Pops was a massively important show for people of my generation because it was a 30-minute window into what's going on in the top 40. And the first time I saw Bowie play on Top of the Pops was when he did Starman from the Ziggy Stardust album. It would have been June, I'm guessing, 72. I was 12. And he was just an alien. I mean, you know, these days you see this stuff and, of course, you're worldly wise and you go, yeah, right, whatever. But back then, this the red hair, the green suit, Mick Ronson, people of all walks and of life have said when he threw his arm around Mick Ronson's shoulder that their parents were horrified, you know. And we're thinking, I remember hearing stories about Alice Cooper horrifying parents and thinking this is a good thing, you know. It'll never happen again because the world's moved on. You know, I became a fan that day. And of course, then you go to school the next day and everybody's talking about this performance by David Bowie. And then, of course, when you save up your pocket money to go out and buy Ziggy Stardust, you kind of realize, and don't forget, we didn't have Wikipedia. We didn't have internet. You had to do it by word of mouth. We'd then discover that there's four other David Bowie albums to buy. You know, going backwards, you've got Hunky Dory. You've got Man Who Sold the World. You've got Space Oddity, which was originally called David Bowie. And then you've got the early Anthony Newley era sounding stuff that he did. There was just, you know, 5 or 6 hours of Bowie you could buy if you could afford it, you know. The same thing happened with Elton John. I think he probably broke on his fourth or fifth album. And the same thing with T-Rex. All these bands have been knocking around forever, but we never knew about it because they were never on Top of the Pops, see. So he became like an integral part of my life and has been ever since. I was very fortunate enough to meet him a bunch of times and he was always very gracious and very welcoming and almost kind of found it kind of funny that the guy that's in this supposed rock band was a big fan of him when most people that, you know, stood up to be counted were people like Robert Smith from The Cure or Holly Johnson from Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Susie and the Banshees, you know, I mean, you could go Gary Newman, and then there was me. It was really weird. But he was great. He was really cool. And now I'm blessed that I literally just a few days ago did the last of three celebrating David Bowie shows with all the guys that have been in his band, from Mike Garson in 72 to Earl Slick joining in 74, all the way through to people like Gail Ann Dorsey, Mark Platy, Sterling Campbell. Just did these shows, two of them in the Wilton. They did a show in New York. I was at the London show and I did the two Wilton shows in LA. And I got up and did Suffragette City, which just happened to be the first song Def Leppard ever played back in 77. And I did All the Young Dudes, which is, you know, the anthem of my generation. So I was blessed to be able to say thanks for everything you've given me back to him while he was sat up on the cloud watching us, hopefully.
And there will be a next time. Not just a title, it's a promise. On DVD, Blu-ray, and two CDs, the next best thing to seeing Def Leppard live in North America, beginning April 8th. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my buddy for many, many years, Joe Elliott of Def Leppard. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2017. All rights reserved. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.